All right, so how did Ramsey theory enter into Monex space theory? What I'll be talking about, for the most part, I'm going to have X to be a real separable infinite dimensional Banach space. When I write Y is contained in X, that's going to mean that Y is a closed linear subspace, also infinite dimensional, unless I tell you otherwise. And a lot of problems are of this type. You have an infinite dimensional X, and the question is there an infinite dimensional slice, subspace Y, that maybe has some property? You're searching for a very nice subspace in an arbitrary X, or maybe you have an X which has certain characteristics and you suspect it should have a subspace with some other structure, and so you ask, can you find it? Well, big problem here is, how do you search amongst all the subspaces of an infinite dimensional Banach space? How do you, is there any sort of systematic way to go through them? There's just too many subspaces, and it's a real problem. But one thing we can always do is assume we have a coordinate system. X always has a subspace with a basis, and for many problems, let's see if this works. Is that readable? Okay, so for X always contains a subspace with a basis. So for example, if you were just looking for an arbitrary subspace of an X with a certain property, you could pretend X had a basis. And this means you have a coordinate system. So you can think of X as just being the completion of the C00, which are the finitely supported real sequences, in such a way that these guys, the unit vectors, become a normalized basis for X. And that criterion just says this, that if you look at any expansion and you project it, you restrict it to an initial segment of coordinates, those projections are uniformly bounded. All right, such a sequence is C basic. And so we only have to look at all subspaces of such a space. Let me take you back 30 plus years ago, the types of problems that people were looking at to motivate how Ramsey theory came into use in Banach spaces. One of the problems was, does every X contain a subspace isomorphic to little lp for some p between 1 and infinity, or C0? And I'm not going to keep you in suspense to the answers to these. I told when they were answered and who answered them. Cyrilson proved this was no. The simplest, most fundamental Banach spaces, the easiest ones you can construct, are the little lp or the C0 space. And so it was hoped at one point in time that that these are somehow some sort of fundamental atoms that had their or building blocks that had to be present inside of every X. And part of the reason that that was hoped to be true, well, people didn't know otherwise, but when they searched through the known spaces and they checked any space they could check, after a bit of time, sometimes easily, sometimes with a big struggle, they could prove that all the known spaces contained one of these spaces, and it was hoped that it might be true. Cyrilson showed this to be false with a really different kind of example. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. Somehow it was a fundamentally different notion of a Banach space. Another problem that occurred was, does every X contain a subspace with an unconditional basis? So in addition to the basis condition that the projections on the first n coordinates are uniformly bounded, unconditional basis is that the projection on any set of coordinates is uniformly bounded. And combinatorially, you can see this is much more difficult to achieve than that, because we just have a lot more of these projections. And so such a sequence, if we have a constant C here, we'll call it C unconditional. Gowers and Moret showed this to be false, famous paper in 93. Another question related to these first two, does every X contain a subspace Y which is either little L1 or C0 or reflexive? And Gowers showed that to be false in 94. And where am I? few more problems. Does every X contain a subspace Y, which can be written as the direct sum of two infinite dimensional subspaces, W and Z? So then W and Z would be called complemented in the space. So you can you decompose every, does every X contain some subspace which can be non-trivially decomposed into two subspaces? In particular, you see you'd have a non-trivial operator on the space Y. You could project Y onto W, so you'd have an operator. It's non-trivial. It'd have infinite dimensional kernel and be an isomorphism onto its range. I should note back here that if you had an unconditional basis, then whenever you split the unconditional basis into two disjoint sets, you'd have natural projections onto the span, closely to your span of those two different sets. So in such a case, you'd have plenty of non-trivial operators, non-trivial projections. More general, and this was shown to be false by this same paper. Can't do that. We'll get into that more later. Fifth question, does every X, generalization of four, does every X contain a subspace Y which admits some non-trivial operator onto itself? So I won't say anything more about this now. It was partially solved by this paper of Gowers and Moret. And then another question, which I'll explain later, is what spaces are distortable. But I'm going to hold off on what that means. Where am I? Am I on this side? All right, so we're assuming X has a basis. We want to look in the subspaces of X, somehow systematically check through all the subspaces of X. So suppose X has a basis EI, let me come over here. We can usually confine our search to subspaces of X which are given, which are actually block subspaces of X. So Y has a basis which is in fact a block basis of the basis for X, and this is the picture and the definition of the block basis. Y1, so this line represents E1, E2, E3, and so on. Y1 is a linear combination of certain of the E's, and then starting after that integer, Y2 is a combination of some more. It can be zero in between. It doesn't have to be consecutive. This is a block basis. It's automatically a basic sequence. And in most of the problems that we ask, because of perturbation, every subspace of a space with a basis essentially contains one of these block bases. So most of the problems we're looking at, we have a basis, we want to check all the block bases, see if we have some sort of structure with it. Now, Ramsey theory, so let's switch and go to Ramsey theory. In general forms, we have a certain structure it could be infinitely, but for us, and usually it's finitely colored. And some substructure should be monochromatic. Right? Ramsey theory in its simplest form. Applications to analysis, of course, you have to have some sort of epsilon in there. So typically, you might finitely color some structure, and some substructure is, maybe you can't say it's monochromatic, but at least in some substructure, every point in it is maybe distance epsilon if you have some sort of metric to one fixed color. All right, let's go to the original Ramsey theory. Original flavor of Ramsey theory. Ramsey's original theorem from 29. Let's finitely color the length n subsequences of the integers. Then there's an infinite subsequence of the integers such that all of its length n subsequences are the same color. And this can be generalized to infinite subsequences of the integers. But you have to have some property about the coloring. And I put one theorem up, Galvin Prickery in 73. Finitely color the infinite subsequences of the integers in some nice fashion. For example, all the subsequences of one particular color might form a Borel set in the product or pointwise topology. Then you can find an infinite subsequence of the integers such that all of its further subsequences are the same color. Now, you can see how this would fit into the sort of problem we're looking at. I have a Banach space with a basis. I want to look at all subspaces, which are all black bases. Well, in particular, this might be good for looking at subsequences of a fixed basis. Subspaces spanned by subsequences. Usually the application's not quite as direct as that, but it's still of the nature. We might have a particular sequence. Maybe we know that every subsequence has a further subsequence with some particular property. If the property's nice, we can get one subsequence such that all of its subsequences have the same property. And maybe we can make some deductions because of that. All right. Let me give you the original. As far as I know, this is the original application of Ramsey theory to Banach spaces. Maybe one of the experts can correct me on that. But the original application, Brunel-Sutcheston in 74, was that of the existence of spreading models. We'll start out with a normalized basic sequence. And there's a lot of epsilons here. The idea, let's focus on this condition. I'll start out with a normalized basic sequence. I'm going to pass to a subsequence, which I'm calling yi. So the yi's are a subsequence here. Suppose you fix a sequence of scalars, and you form this linear combination where the i's are increasing. So you have the sequence of y's. You put an a1 on one term, a2 here, a3, keeping the same order as the subsequence. As you move these coefficients around, this finite set of coefficients around to different coordinates, of course, the norm can change. But the norm is no more, since it's a finite sequence and a triangle inequality, the norm is between 0 and the L1 norm of the AJs, in this case, between 0 and n. So if you partition, so we know that the norm of every such expression is between 0 and n. Let's just chop that interval up into a finite number of subintervals of size maybe less than epsilon, or some epsilon. Then the original flavor Ramsey theorem says, Ramsey, the theorem one up there, says I can find a subsequence so that all of these expressions have the same norm. I can find a subsequence of the natural of xi such that when, and let's call then that subsequence yi, such that whenever I compute this for any such sequence i1 up to in, these norms are all the same up to an epsilon. So I can achieve this condition that I'm talking about for a fixed epsilon, for a fixed sequence of AJs from 1 to n, then if I use some sort of compactness argument and diagonalization argument, I can actually get what's done here. If I'm looking at the norm of any combination of the yi's, preserving the order, I have n coefficients. If I start at the nth condition, these are all essentially the same. How much the same up to some epsilon n, which is decreasing to 0. And so you get that the iterated limit exists. And then this can be used to define a norm on C00, our old friend C00, which makes this into a very nice space. That's called a spreading model. So EI is a 1. It's a 1 basis. It's a basis with constant 1. Well, actually, I shouldn't have said that. It makes it into a basis. It's not always 1 most of the time. It is 1 subsymmetric, meaning that if I compute the norm of any linear combination of the E's and then I take the coordinates, the A1, A2, and I just spread them out, preserving the order, I get the same norm. And that's so the basis is spreading or subsymmetric. And we also have a very nice fact that people noticed quite quickly after Brunel and Sutcheston did this was that if the original sequence xi or the yi sequence is weakly null, then this spreading model is 1 unconditional. And as we'll see, we'll see that these are very prevalent, these weakly null sequences. So At least if you have a normalized weakly null sequence in your Banach space, then you can use Ramsey theory to extract this unconditional object. The only trouble is this is not a subspace of your original space. It only lives in it asymptotically. If I want to compute the norm of something like this, I have to go inside of the space, but the vectors that reflect this norm up to an arbitrary epsilon and error change as the length of the sequence gets bigger. So it lives inside the space, but only asymptotically, and it's not, in general, a subspace of your space. So we have this unconditional object tied to the space, but it's generally not a subspace of the space. All right, let's go back to, I told you one of the questions was, does every Banach space contain a reflexive space, or C0 or L1? And that was ultimately solved in the negative by Gowers. Let's go back to that problem, though. So we're back again 30 years ago. We know from Banach space theory, basic functional analysis, that a space is non-reflexive if and only if one of the following two things happens. We have a normalized sequence with no weak Cauchy subsequence. And by that, we mean whenever you pick a subsequence, there's an element of the dual space so that this sequence of reals diverges. Or we do have a weak Cauchy sequence, but it's actually not converging weakly to any element of the space. X star of yi converges for all x star, but there's no element y of the space so that this is converging to x star of y. And let's interpret that another way. Think of it this way. Remember, my space X is separable, so it's dual ball in the weak star topology. So that's the topology and the dual ball generated by X. It's compact metrizable. And the elements of X naturally then sit inside of the continuous functions on K, and X star star sits naturally inside, let's say, little L infinity of K, the objects defined on the real-valued functions on K under the soup norm. So we can say that X is reflexive if and only if every bounded sequence in X has a subsequence. So this is the things in X are continuous functions on K. So every bounded sequence in X has a subsequence that is pointwise convergent to a continuous function on K. It may not have a pointwise convergent subsequence. It may have a pointwise convergent subsequence, but the limit is not continuous. And this would reflect then what happens in B above. All right, remarkably, I think this is Rosenthal's L1 theorem, I think, is one of the prettiest theorems of Banach space theory. It says that if you look at these two criteria, and if you take the first criterion, your Banach space must always contain little L1. Okay, so if you have condition A, then some subsequence of xi, call it yi, satisfies this inequality for some constant C. So it's actually just a sequence. So the span of the yi's is isomorphic to the little L1 basis. And why do I mention this theorem in particular? Because it can be proved using it. One of the key lemmas in this theorem can be proved using Ramsey theory. And I gave you one application of Ramsey theory that was with Brunel Sechestin. And I'm going to tell you a number of results and influences of Ramsey theory without giving you too many proofs. So I wanted to indicate very briefly how Ramsey theory can be used in this. Now, Rosenthal didn't use Ramsey theory when he originally wrote it, but a few years later, somebody noticed that one of the key lemmas could be also achieved using Ramsey theory. So this is how it enters into play. And so if you haven't seen this before, it's kind of fun. You can play around with it, try to prove it with Ramsey theory. It's just a sequence about sequences of sets. I have some fixed set S, a sequence of pairwise disjoint, a sequence of subsets A and a BN, which are disjoint, and I have a certain property. Whenever I look at any subsequences of the integers, any subsequence of the ANs and BNs, some point in S is in infinitely many of the ANs and infinitely many of the BNs coming out of that subsequence. Then you can prove that there's some infinite subsequence of the integers with this property. If you take any two finite disjoint collections of that subsequence, F and G, you can find a point that's in those corresponding ANs and those corresponding BNs. And this is used then to show that in this case, the sequence XI has a subsequence which is in some sense, looks like the Rademacher functions as it sits upon the dual ball K. It's not necessarily 1 and minus 1, but it's big on certain things and small, and they have the same sort of independence properties that the Rademachers have. And the Rademachers in L infinity of 0, 1, of course, form little L1. All right, following up on this, or a year later or something, Rosenthal and myself showed X does not contain an isomorph of little L1 is the same as saying that the second dual is actually a subset of the bare one functions on K. And so if you were looking at arbitrary Banach space and you wanted to find nice subspaces inside it, you can say, all right, well, if it contains little L1, I'm done. If it doesn't contain little L1, oh, everything in the second dual is already a bare one function. And this leads naturally to problems about saying, well, let's see what kind of bare one functions we could possibly have in the second dual. And does this say something about the substructure of X or the Banach space of X? And there's some results of that type, but I'm not going to go into that. All right, one thing worth noting from Rosenthal's theorem, we either have little L1 or we have a normalized weakly null basic sequence. So in the second case, we have this very nice unconditional spreading model. All right, next natural question is, all right, if you take a normalized, so we have little L1, nice object, or we have this normalized weakly null sequence, which has a spreading model. Spreading model is unconditional. Maybe a subsequence of XI itself is already unconditional. And that was shown to be false. Moray and Rosenthal in 77 said, no, that's not the case. And they had this very, very pretty, clever construction of such a sequence. And this construction really played a nice role in the work of Gowers and Moray 15 years later, when they solved the unconditional basic sequence problem. This idea that they used there played a key role in that. I want to mention a very pretty theorem of John Elton from 78 that also used Ramsey theory, and I'll try to say a few words again how Ramsey theory entered into the proof of this result once I describe it. Take a normalized weakly null sequence. It need not have an unconditional subsequence, but there's a weak form of unconditionality. Let's look ahead to the conclusion here. I was going to project onto some set F, and I said I could do that with norm no worse than C of delta. And where did this delta come into play? Well, this is a constant, which is the delta was the actually, you can read this as I can look at the absolute value of the AIs as I range over F, and delta is the smallest of those numbers. All right, so once more, I can find a subsequence so that if I'm looking at coefficients bounded between minus 1 and 1, and I project onto any set where all the coefficients are at least delta in absolute value, then the norm does not exceed some constant C of delta. Of course, I could not do this uniformly because of the Mori-Rosenthal example. But this is a very nice partial unconditionality result. And how does Ramsey theory come into play? Very beautiful argument. Well, normally, a lot of arguments where you try to prove some inequality like this go as follows. The norm of an element is given by x star of the element for some elements of the dual ball. So x star is norm 1, x star of the element is the norm of the element. If I can find such an x star, which is 0 on all of the coordinates outside of f, I immediately get this inequality actually with constant 1. All right, so suppose I pick an element that norms this object. Well, I have the sum can be broken into four parts. The ais are positive. X star of yi is positive, or so on. There's four different pieces. One of those pieces is at least a quarter of the norm. So we can, up to a factor of 4, we can reduce to, and by making f a little smaller, I can reduce to this situation where I have this. Oh, this is I didn't write it anywhere, did I? This is supposed to be, x star of this is supposed to be the norm of the element. I should have written that somewhere. But in any event, both of these sequences of coefficients are positive. And so I'm bothered by this. Let me just write it somewhere. Okay. Choose an element to the dual ball which gives the norm. So I have this expression. What do I know about the AIs? I've assumed that they're all between delta and 1. So up to a factor of delta, the sum of the x star and the yi's is, in fact, the norm. But of course, I've lost a lot. I've lost some factor of delta, but I don't care because I'm going to have some constant coming in here that depends upon delta. So what I want to do now to prove Elton's theorem is to actually find a subsequence, yi, of my original weakly null sequence so that whenever I have this sort of situation, I can replace x star by another element of the dual ball, which preserves this L1 mass of x star over the sequence, and is essentially 0 outside of the sequence. Now, I may have to actually cut down the sequence a little to a smaller set, but that's okay. Then the same argument works. The norm of this expression is up to something in delta dependent y star of this sum, this is over g. And since y star was 0 on the elements of yi outside of my set g, the rest of the argument goes through. So Ramsey theory came into play in this regard. We said you wanted to show that given the sequence xi, weakly null, you could find a subsequence so that whenever you had an element x star with a certain positive L1 mass on a set, it could be replaced by another element with the same positive L1 mass on the set, but which was essentially 0 outside. It's a dual. Let me see, which is... there's a dual theorem a few years ago. Argyros, Merkourakis, and Seropoulos, 98, and I'll put that up quickly. This is dual to Elton's theorem, and it's interesting. It took, when was it? What's Elton's theorem state? I forget. Elton's theorem was 78, so this is 20 years later. For every positive delta, I have an A of delta. So it's another sort of unconditionality. For every delta, we have a constant A of delta. So that if I start out with a normalized weakly null sequence, some subsequence yi satisfies this type of unconditionality. If we take an absolute convex combination and that happens to be at least delta norm, then you can change signs. The norm is still at least as large as A of delta. And I quickly mention a couple of other. Of course, I should say there's a lot of applications of Ramsey theorem to bonic spaces, and I'm just selecting some of them as we go through this. We're going to make a big jump soon into the 90s. So I'll give you a couple more things from the 80s. And since I get to select, I pick some of my theorems I happen to like for some reason. Elton and myself, actually, Ramsey theorem plays a small part here, but you can always find, well, the way I wrote it, some spreading model, which is 1 plus epsilon separated, the unit vector basis. So in particular, any infinite-dimensional bonic space, the ball contains this infinite sequence, any two of them are at least 1 plus epsilon apart. For some epsilon, it depends upon the space. And I'll give you one more that uses Ramsey theorem. Theorem of Knaust and myself from 89. This sort of statement set up for Ramsey theorem. Pick a normalized weakly null sequence, then assume that whenever you have this normalized, well, assume the bonic space has the property that every normalized weakly null sequence has a subsequence with an upper LP estimate. So that's this inequality. Then, in fact, this constant C can be chosen well, there is a uniform constant that works for all such sequences in the bonic space. And it's another theorem using Ramsey theorem. All right, so now I'm going to move ahead. You can see this. I started out with the original Ramsey theorem and then the Galvin-Pickering version. There's many generalizations of Ramsey theory. And some of them have been used in bonic space theory. Some of them deal with, remember, our real problem is in searching for all subspaces of a bonic space, we have to look through all of the block bases. And some of them actually dealt with block bases in some form of a bonic space, and they had applications. But they weren't successful enough to, for example, solve the unconditional basic sequence problem or give us real insight there. Let's move to the ideal Ramsey theorem. All right, so instead of dealing with sequences and subsequences, the ideal Ramsey theorem for a bonic space X would be something like this. Suppose you finitely color the unit sphere. This is normal in elements in X. Finitely color them, take some epsilon. Then you would like to say that there's a subspace. Remember, all my subspaces are infinite dimensional. There's a Z-contained. Oh, and for technical reasons, I've stated it this way. I want to get a subspace which is nearly monochromatic, but I've stated it. Every Z contained in X contains a further space Y, so that the sphere of Y is nearly monochromatic. There's some fixed color. And everything in the sphere of Y is within epsilon distance of something of that fixed color. All right, this would be the ultimate Ramsey theorem for a bonic space X. And if X had a basis, it would be enough to work with block subspaces. There's nothing special. This is actually equivalent to the following. What do I mean by saying it? I mean, in other words, X would satisfy the ultimate Ramsey theorem, should be equivalent, if I've done it correctly, to this. Whenever you look at a real-valued Lipschitz function on the unit sphere of X and pick any positive epsilon, then to emphasize, for all Z contained in X, there's some subspace Y, so that F is nearly constant on the sphere of Y. And I wrote this, the oscillation of F on the sphere is smaller than epsilon. If you want to relate the two, If you think of, well, going back and forth, for example, if you couldn't stabilize this finite coloring in the first case, you'd have two colors, and you couldn't get into one of them within an epsilon. You could just take one of those colors and look at the Lipschitz function, which measured the distance from any point in the sphere to a point in that set. So you'd be looking at the distance from a set to a point, but the set being everything a fixed color blue, and maybe you're going back and forth always between blue and red. So this Lipschitz function would not be stabilizing. And you can go the other way, too. All right, so so the question is then, we take the ultimate Ramsey theorem for x. Does maybe every x satisfies the ultimate Ramsey theorem, or what spaces would satisfy the ultimate Ramsey theorem? Well, there's some evidence that suggests maybe something could be done, but also evidence that suggests you can't do everything. This is a little bit out of order chronologically, but Gower's proved that C0 satisfies the ultimate Ramsey theorem. He has this beautiful argument using ultrafilters, and it's not a long paper, but it gets, they're just beautiful using ultrafilters. So Gower's proved that C0 has this property. If we look for evidence that a Banach space should satisfy the ultimate Ramsey theorem in general, we go back to work of Milman in the 60s, Kervin in 76. I've combined some things. We could say, yeah, every Banach space satisfies the ultimate Ramsey theorem in a finite sense as follows. Pick an epsilon positive. Should be for all n. For all n and epsilon, you can, let's assume x has a basis, as we may. For all n and epsilon, there's some n-dimensional block subspace of the basis for x where, well, we get things in a very nice way. This sequence is essentially the unit vector basis of little lpn up to an epsilon for some p between 1 and infinity. That's from Kervin's theorem. And also, if I look at the unit sphere of this finite dimensional subspace, remember it's arbitrarily long, it was monochromatic up to an epsilon. So finitely, there was hope. But if we go back in time, actually, Thurlson from 74, his space showed that it could not be the case that every Banach space satisfied the ultimate Ramsey theorem. T. Thurlson space from 74, and I'll tell you more in the next slide, admits an equivalent norm that does not stabilize, and T is called distortable. So let me give you that definition. All right, X, a Banach space is distortable. Well, we quantify it. We'll say it's lambda distortable, where lambda is bigger than 1, if you can renorm it so that this property holds. So the single bar norm is some renorming, double bar norm is the original norm. You can renorm it so that in every subspace, this supremum is bigger than lambda. Let me explain what that means geometrically. I think I have an empty slide here. All right, there's the two unit spheres, equivalent, well, not very good ones, two equivalent unit spheres for a Banach space. So equivalent just means that if you start with either of the unit spheres, it can be expanded, if necessary, to contain the entire sphere. That's all it means to say that they're equivalent. And, of course, the unit sphere gives us the geometry of the Banach space. You want to know how to measure distance along this axis? Well, this is one unit. Along this axis, this is one unit. So we get different geometry according to this norm. This would be one unit according to the norm given by the sphere along this axis. And the question of distortion then is, for Banach space, suppose you start with any two, with the original norm and then any equivalent norm, are you fundamentally changing the geometry of this Banach space? I mean, what's the easiest way to get an equivalent norm on Banach space? I take a sphere and I say, all right, here's the sphere and here's my new sphere. I just multiply, multiply by a constant. So all you're doing is changing scale, feet to inches or something. The question here is, can you fundamentally, whereas in this case, you see, these two spheres, this is not just a multiple of the inner sphere. That's clear. But in this case, if I were to, say, take a cross-section like this, well, of course, on this cross-section, the new sphere is just a multiple of the old sphere. So then the question becomes, all right, suppose you have, now we're doing this in infinite dimensions. We have these two infinite dimensional spheres. Either one can be expanded to contain the other. Can we slice through it infinite dimensionally so that when I look in this cross section, right, and I look at them, I say, oh, those are the two same spheres, except one's been multiplied just by a constant up to some arbitrarily small epsilon. So this is the question of distortion. X is lambda distortable if you don't have that property. You can somehow fundamentally change its geometry, at least in every infinite dimensional slice. It's different. Of course, finitely, as we've seen, finitely that the opposite is true. All right, so and there's a parameter involved here. That's some lambda bigger than 1. Arbitrary distortion would say that it's lambda distortable for all lambda bigger than 1. All right, so we had the first distortable space. That was Cyrilson from 94. 74, thank you. Got too many dates. Schlimperk from 91. So Thomas constructed the first arbitrarily distortable space, and it's been called S since then. And this played a huge role. I told you the Morey-Rosenthal argument example played a big role. The Schlimperk space also played a huge role in the Gowers-Morey example, and lots of other discoveries in the 90s on Banach spaces. Oh, okay. All right, so then the question was, we had these two questions we were looking at. What Banach spaces, if any, other than C0, would satisfy the ultimate Ramsey theorem? And then we have the notion of distortion, which is really asking whether every Lipschitz function which happens to be an equivalent norm would stabilize on the Banach space. You're cutting down. You don't have all the Lipschitz functions, but the ones which happen to be given by equivalent norms. Would these stabilize on the Banach space? And so I'm going to give you the answers, not the proofs. Even Hilbert space fails to be satisfy this property. So our nicest space, in some sense, you would think Hilbert space is usually the nicest space, although in this setting, C0 is the nicest space. So Hilbert space is arbitrarily distortable, and in fact, you get this really cute sequence of sets. Pick any sequence epsilon decreasing to 0. You get a sequence of sets, A1, A2, A3, and so on, subsets of the unit sphere, which are very large. They contain an element in every infinite dimensional subspace, and they're nearly orthogonal. You pick an element from one set, an element from a different set, and then you could even make the coordinates positive, take their inner product, and you get almost 0. So these are nearly orthogonal. Once you have these, I didn't say how you get distortion from this. Once you have these, you can let... So how do you get arbitrary distortion? Whoops. you can take just epsilon n times the original norm plus the supremum. You can use this. I'll learn. You can use this element of the dual of L2, which is the dual ball, as a set of norming functionals to define the norm. You put this in just actually to make sure it's a norm instead of a semi-norm. So it's easy to check that these arbitrarily distort. All right, I'll take you back then. Remember, ultimate Ramsey theorem for any Banach space, or which Banach spaces are distortable. Gower's in 90-something, C0 satisfies ultimate Ramsey theorem. If we go way back to 64, James proved that C0 and little L1 are not distortable. So if you only look at stabilizing the equivalent functions which are given, Lipschitz functions which are given by equivalent norms, you can also throw little L1 into the category of nice space. If you combine results of Gower's and Milman and OS, then you get an answer completely to these questions I mentioned. X satisfies the ultimate Ramsey theorem if and only if X is C0 saturated. By that, it doesn't have to be C0, but every subspace for all X contained, for all Y contained in X, C0 embeds into Y. So wherever you look inside the space, every slice contains a copy of C0. Oops, let me leave that. All right, if you put together then work of, I guess, James and Milman, then we get this answer to the which spaces are distortable, at least in this sense. X does not contain a distortable space if and only if F is X is L1 slash C0 saturated, meaning every subspace of X contains either little L1 or C0. There's a natural, there's this natural bound, apparently, in terms of distortion. I tell you what it means to be distortable. It means it's lambda distortable for some lambda bigger than 1, arbitrarily distortable for every lambda. You could imagine a space of bounded distortion whereby it's distortable but not arbitrarily so you could quantify it. And there's this beautiful theorem which I've combined of Milman and Nicole. And Moiret also wrote about this problem that says, if you take a space of bounded distortion, okay, which I'll talk about this, we don't know that any such space exists, so I'll talk about this a little bit, then it must contain an unconditional basic sequence, EI, which is asymptotically LP for some P, and by that I just mean pick any N and look at N blocks starting after the nth coordinate, then they should be uniformly equivalent for some C to the unit vector basis of LPN. All right, so we had this great question. I think it's a great question. Does there exist an X which is distortable but of bounded distortion? And it would seem, I don't know exactly, first we have to know what the space is if such a thing exists. So I think it's very interesting whether it exists or not. I got this from Tim Gowers, who was saying that he thought it'd be very interesting for the reason that if such a space existed, then X would satisfy some sort of, it wouldn't satisfy the, it satisfies some sort of weak Ramsey theorem. There's bad colorings given by equivalent norms, but they wouldn't be too bad in some sense. We'd probably have to know what the space is first to know what this is, but anyway, seems that it might be interesting in some sense. Curiously, the very first distortable space ever known was Cyrielson space, T. And it's known to be 2 minus epsilon distortable. I give you that parameter lambda. Well, the parameter can be taken arbitrarily close to 2, but we don't know anything better than that. And if you look at, I'm going to talk about T a little bit more in a second. If you look at, T also has these properties. It has a nice unconditional basis and basic and it's asymptotic L1. So, oh, and work of Moret suggests that, we don't know for sure, that, I shouldn't say it, but it seems that the thing that you should be checking, when you're looking at this, it's possible that maybe we can eliminate the case where P is strictly between 1 and infinity. We can eliminate it in a lot of cases. For example, the space does not contain little L1s and uniformly. Wait a minute now. Oh, I thought I was going to say more about T. I guess not right here. Let me move ahead, wrapping up, to go to Gower's Black-Ramsey theorem, which, I guess some of us hoped that at one time that maybe there's some nice Black-Ramsey theorem that exists and it'll show that every Banach space contains an unconditional basic sequence. Of course, that was shown not to be the case, but it turns out that there is a Black-Ramsey theorem. It's not as strong as we thought, and it doesn't show the theorem I just said, but it shows that you either have that or another extreme alternative, and it turned out to be very interesting. So, let me see. Gower's Black-Ramsey theorem, and I just stated it up there. Suppose you have a Banach space X with a basis EI. You look at all finite length normalized Bloch bases. Call that sigma, capital sigma. Look at a subset little sigma of these, and assume that that subset little sigma is large in the sense that every Bloch subspace Y of X contains a sequence which, when you tack them together, gets you inside of sigma. We need an epsilon, in this case, a sequence of epsilons or a sequence of deltas, delta I. Gower's theorem says that under this condition, so sigma is a large collection of finite normalized Bloch bases of X. We have some positive deltas. Gower's theorem says we can find one Bloch subspace so that player V has a winning strategy against S in the following game. S plays Bloch subspaces. They alternate plays. X plays X1. V, the vector, so S is for subspace, V is for vector. V picks an element X1 in the unit sphere of X1. S plays X2, any Bloch subspace of X, does not have to be a subspace of X1. V plays X2 in the unit sphere of X2, and so on. And V wins the game. If we ultimately, if the plays of V ultimately can be wind up inside of sigma. And a corollary of this. So, without actually too much work, it takes a little, you get this beautiful theorem. Every X either contains an unconditional basic sequence or it contains an HI subspace. HI hereditarily indecomposable. And I talked about this a little earlier. Question was, could you write a Banach space as the direct sum of two infinite dimensional subspaces? And if it's HI, you cannot. One of them would have to be finite dimensional. And if it's HI, not only can you not write Y as the direct sum of two infinite dimensional subspaces, but no subspace can be written in this way. So this is very different than having the unconditional basis where you have lots of projections of this type. All right, a lot has been discovered. So the first HI space then was constructed by Gowers and Moret when they solved the unconditional basic sequence problem. The space was HI, as they noticed, before we knew this theory. A lot has been discovered since then in the 90s about HI spaces. Spyros Argyros has been the main mover, I think, in this, and he's written some really beautiful papers on HI spaces, and I put plus plus because he's written a lot of papers, and he's had a lot of co-authors in those papers. I want to mention one other consequence of this. If you combine work of Gowers and Nicole, Tomczyk, Jagerman, you get this really beautiful theorem that... And Komorowski, yeah. But you can see I threw this in late, and then I forgot to put the... if X is isomorphic, Banach space, which is isomorphic to all of its subspaces, then it must be Hilbert space. Okay, this is the homogeneous Banach space problem. All right, I think I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. I was going to tell you some open problems, because if anybody happened to read my abstract, I promised some open problems, but... So I was preparing this yesterday. I figured I didn't have time for open problems. And also, I'm on this panel tomorrow. We're supposed to mention open problems, so I'll save it for then.